What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
Mark Latham. Mark Latham joins me this afternoon for his regular spot. Hello, Mark.
G'day there, Brent. Always good to talk to you on a Thursday.
Likewise, mate. Let's get stuck into it. The Israeli military has raided Gaza's main hospital. It's described it as a targeted operation against Hamas. An eyewitness at Al-Shifa Hospital said that troops moved in overnight and were interrogating people. Yesterday, Israel said it found Hamas's operational centre at the hospital and shared images of what it said was Hamas's weapons and equipment, or Hamas weapons and equipment. Of course, Hamas denies operating there, and neither side can basically verify their claims, Mark.
Well, the Americans independently have verified the Israeli claims. The Americans are saying it has been used by Hamas as their command centre, and my understanding is that's a war crime. You can just imagine the horror of a terrorist organisation basically taking the hospital hostage and having tunnels and rooms underneath the hospital, apparently, where they've run this dreadful operation to slaughter innocent Israelis and then protect themselves, you know, real cowards, protect themselves by the shield of sick and dying people above them in the hospital. So, you know, there's always a lot of outrage if the Israelis do anything about a hospital, but the greater outrage, of course, the thing that instigated it, is Hamas using Al-Shifa Hospital as a shield against its own evil. And this is, you know, as bad as it gets. So you can hardly blame the Israelis. It must be a very difficult operation. How do you weed out Hamas in that facility without hurting the ill patients that are trying to recover in the normal way? So, you know, on the ground for the Israelis, it's a very difficult operation. We'll have to see how it unfolds.
As you say, according to international humanitarian law, hospitals are specially protected facilities. Because of that, that is why Hamas have done what they've done and set up underneath the hospital.
Well, exactly. And we've heard through this engagement, this war, if you like, since the 7th of October, various outrage on the Arab side of the argument about the Israelis doing anything about a hospital. There was an ordnance that exploded in the car park, and the media straight away assumed it was the Israelis that had launched that missile. It turns out it was Islamic Jihad with one of their misfiring missiles. So there's been a lot of bad publicity for the Israelis about any attack or anything to do with a hospital. Of course, you know, it sounds terrible, doesn't it? But in the substance of it, Hamas using the hospital in this way is a war crime. It just confirms the Israelis are right in trying to eliminate Hamas. People who do this sort of thing have no place in a decent society. So you can't blame the Israelis for taking action. And I suppose they'll try and get Hamas out of the hospital and try and return it to being a normal medical facility, which it should always have been.
Absolutely.
And imagine the danger you place the patients in by Hamas doing this.
Back home, more details regarding the government's amendments to the Migration Act were revealed this morning, on top of the use of ankle bracelets, curfews and fresh criminal offences for breaching conditions. Released detainees are going to be banned from working with children and they will have to seek approval before beginning any form of work. This is happening as we speak, Mark.
Well, it's a terrible decision of the High Court, and common sense will tell you that if the 83 people released aren't allowed to work with children, they need to have curfews applied to them and ankle bracelets. What are they doing out in society? They should have remained in detention. We're talking about murderers, rapists, pedophiles. These are not people who, under the normal natural justice of the Australian system, deserve their freedom. So you can only hope that in terms of the constitutionality of it and the laws passing the Parliament, that there's an agreement between Labor and the Coalition to get this right and to make sure it doesn't happen again in the future. You know, it's all right for High Court judges to make these decisions. They wouldn't have to live next door to any of the 83 people we're talking about. They wouldn't have their family worried about these sort of people walking up and down their street. So it's a very bad circumstance, and I haven't seen the legislation. It's fresh before the Parliament, but I hope they've got it right, and I hope it solves any similar problems in the future.
I see that the opposition's Home Affairs spokesman, James Patterson, said today the government's emergency legislation doesn't go far enough, and he wants the opposition to discuss further amendments in reference to this bill. What did he say? He described it as the bare minimum. It was apparently only 18 pages long, and he argues the measures to increase restrictions on those released should have been put in place last week. Does he have a point about that, Mark?
Well, it's a public safety problem immediately that rapists, murderers and pedophiles have been able to exercise their freedom and do whatever they like out on the streets and the suburbs, the towns, wherever they've gone to. And that's a very worrying episode. So he's right in that regard. Maybe they should have, you know, got this before the Parliament, recalled the Parliament a lot faster. It was a surprise High Court decision. Going back to the Howard years, we had... Well, probably going back to the Keating years, actually, we had indefinite detention in Australia of people who, you know, it was the equivalent of being in jail. They weren't fit to be free on our streets. So they needed to get this done faster. Hopefully the opposition has got some good ideas for making it work better in the future. But, you know, where public safety is involved, it would be good to have bipartisanship. The first role of government is to keep its people safe, and hopefully Labor and Liberal can work that out.
Is it your opinion that with the two current Leavers, Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese, they can sit down and actually come up with something with a bipartisan approach? I made the comment yesterday and today. Let's hope this is an example where they can, because, gee whiz, they haven't had any luck in the past. It seems as though if one says the sky is blue, the other will say, no, it's red.
Well, they were at each other in the Parliament yesterday like cat and dog, in a very fierce debate, so that's not a very good sign. But sometimes behind the scenes, the minister and the shadow minister will have cooler heads and they'll sort it out and make a recommendation to their caucus and also their leaders. So the Albanese-Dutton relationship, yesterday Dutton tried to use this Home Affairs problem, this High Court decision, to wrap it into the problem of anti-Semitism in Australia. I'm not too sure that was a great linkage to make. And Albanese attacked him in return. So their relationship looks like it's soured because of that. Albanese took great personal offence at what was being said, whether that's right or wrong. So in the way of politics, though, the carriage is with the minister and the shadow minister, and you'd hope they can be sitting around the table today to sort it out.
Peter Dutton tried to move a bill to, you know, suggest that the Prime Minister not travel overseas, not arrive at APAC. It wasn't going to happen. I mean, do you think the Prime Minister should have stayed in the country?
Well, what's he going to achieve at APAC that he didn't achieve at his last American visit or his last Chinese one?
Right.
And you've got this pressing national security issue, public safety, the High Court decision. Albanese himself spoke of the rise of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism on our streets because of the conflict in Gaza. That in itself is a worry. I mean, people who come to Australia, you think they'd recognise they won the lottery of life, leave the problems behind. That's why you're here in the first place. So it is a distressing time, and of course on top of that you've got all the cost of living issues that aren't going away, they're getting worse with another interest rate rise. So Albanese is racking up a record number of trips, and maybe this is one that he could have passed on to Penny Wong.
Back to New South Wales politics, and apparently Labor has dramatically slashed the number of sitting days for next year, for 2024. Is this true, Mark, and if so, why?
Well, we've discussed this previously, Brent, that the New South Wales Parliament has become a bit of a part-time parliament under the new government. When Barry O'Farrell was elected in 2011, they set up 15 weeks of sittings because they had an election mandate. They had things to do for legislation. But Chris Minns has reduced 2024 to just 11 weeks, and in fact, in the first 4 months of the year, there's only three sitting weeks, 9 days. And the Parliament will sit one day for every fortnight. Now, when people are out there working hard, running small businesses, they think that the Parliament was bludging, according to that schedule. And it has been a remarkable feature of the Minns government. Labor spent 12 years in opposition. You think, oh, they'd come in with a mandate and lots of things they wanted to do and legislate. There was a lot more legislation, and it kept us going more days and later into the evening under the former government, which had been in for 12 years. And now, on a Tuesday night, the upper house doesn't sit. Everyone goes home at dinner. There's barely legislation to keep us going on a Thursday. And this sitting schedule is as skinny as you'll ever see for a parliament that's supposed to be active serving the people. So Chris Minns, well, I think it's true to say, he's hit the ground reviewing. He set up umpteen reviews into just about all aspects of government, but he doesn't seem to have a firm view of what he wants to actually achieve by way of legislation and keep the parliament active.
Well, he promised lots at the election, and when it comes to delivering on election commitments, it seems as though the Minns government has fallen very short.
Well, I think that's right. They said they were going to lift school results. I'm not too sure their actions in appeasing the Teachers Federation are heading down that path. They were going to do a lot about tolls. That's been deferred, and there's doubt as to the detail involved. I can't see any improvements in the hospital system. They've set up a review about emergency departments. I mean, if the people knew they were just electing a series of committees and reviewers, they might have cast a different vote back in March. But the Minns government has been mainly about reviews and bringing in outsiders, people we never heard of during the election campaign, to try and sort out what government policy might be. So they haven't got a lot of original thinking themselves and plans that matter, and that's why the parliament is goofing off and it's become a part-time institution. You know, Brent, back in the day, Bob Carr, when he was Premier, said, oh, you know, we could make most of these MPs part-time and pay them accordingly, and it probably has come to that.
Alexandra Smith wrote an article today. She finished by saying this: in a tight parliament where Labor does not control either house, everything has the potential to become a battle. Clearly, Labor hopes the less time it spends in Macquarie Street, the fewer fights it's going to face and the fewer humiliating losses. She's got a point.
Well, I think she might have missed the substance of it, that it's not that Labor's afraid of a battle or a fight. There's been none of that so far in the parliamentary year. It's more that they haven't got things to put forward to fight about. I think the bigger issue is that Minns is vacuous. He hasn't got legislation and big ambitions for the state. And the parliamentary agenda and the paucity of sitting days reflects that. So I don't detect that Labor's worried about an argument. They, you know, on smaller things, they'll have an argument with the Greens every other day in some parts of the crossbench. But it's more they haven't got the items to put forward to fight about. That's what I'm seeing.
I had a couple of people wanted me to ask you a question about treaty in New South Wales and Chris Minns and treaty. There was an article that I saw, the headline said New South Wales treaty will not progress beyond consultation until after the election. So a state treaty will not progress past consultation and planning in New South Wales until after the next election, as Chris Minns walks back those reconciliation plans. Has he voiced this in Parliament?
Well, I asked the leader in the upper house, Penny Sharp, about it, given the resounding rejection of the voice referendum in New South Wales, and she indicated they weren't proceeding with their own voice. That's good news, respecting the will of the people. But she also indicated that, there'll be no treaty, because they did have an election promise to bring in a treaty with the Indigenous. There'll be no treaty in New South Wales this side of the 2027 election. So they pushed it well out, and she referred to the Victorian process, which has taken over 6 years. You know, Victoria's been consulting for 6 years, and Minns himself has said, oh, well, you've got scores of Indigenous tribes and interests in New South Wales. It's a long, long process to get it right. But I wonder what the treaty is really about. We've got land rights legislation in New South Wales. We've got it federally. They've done the apology. They've done some things about stolen generation. They've flown their flag on the bridge. Not that that makes much difference, but all the Indigenous things that have been demanded over the years, they've happened one by one, except the voice, which the people voted down heavily. So what's left to put in the treaty? I think it just becomes a symbolic document, doesn't it, that talks about sovereignty never ceded and all this sort of stuff that the left go on about. So I'm not too sure for a symbolic document you need to go 4, 5, 6 years, spend many millions of dollars. I think a lot of the money could be spent a lot better in more pressing projects.
Mark, if I can just return to the High Court decision for a moment. I've had a couple of emails from people with this opinion. Your thoughts, your opinion. Any serious High Court decision should have a unanimous vote outcome and not cast any doubt at all. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, not a lot would happen in the High Court.
That's what I thought.
We've got a judicial system that relies on a majority, and there's 7 High Court justices, and 4-3 will carry the day. That's the reality. that's there. I'm not too sure it's written into the Constitution, but it's long, long-standing judicial practice that comes out of our system from the United Kingdom. So to rely on a unanimous decision, it basically means that one government could put in a couple of judges, even just one, who's a contrarian, and the next government that comes in would find that judge constantly blocks rulings, and you'd have gridlock in the High Court. So I think, you know, whether it's 4-3 or 5-2 or 7-0, you've got to let the majority prevail.
Parents at a major regional Catholic college are fighting back against plans by the school to cut time in the classroom to 4 days a week. This is at this is in the Southern Highlands, Mark.
Yeah, Chevalier College. I used to play footy against them. They're in Barrel. And it's bad news for parents, and the parents there who pay over $11,000 in school fees are obviously screaming blue murder about it. I mean, Brent, there's no evidence. Everything about school learning has been studied inside out all over the world. There's hundreds of studies. You can't jump over them. There's no evidence in any of those studies that kids being absent from school is great for their learning. And the principal there has come up with this idea that in the post-COVID world, they need to get used to working from home because that'll be the workplace. Well, maybe, maybe not, but it's not the school's responsibility. You know, it's, if the workplace has got work from home arrangements, in the future the workplace would sort that out. The school's responsibility is to give them the best possible academic and vocational results and start in life. And having years 10, 11 and 12 home on a Monday, it's a nightmare for parents, logistically, obviously. And it makes you wonder, well, if the kids can skip school on Monday, what about the rest of the week? What's the school doing there that's so good for them and beneficial? Teachers must teach. They must be at the front of the classroom directly instructing and engaging with their students, not having the kids sitting at home.
Well said. Let's talk cricket, World Cup cricket. India's into the final, and tonight, what is it, from 7:30, I believe, Australian Eastern Daylight Time, it's South Africa takes on Australia, or Australia takes on South Africa, and you know, go the Aussies. But some of the reports that I'm reading is that people are basically putting the money with South Africa to beat Australia, Mark.
Well, there's the weather factor. Apparently there's some rain depression or even cyclone moving in. I'm not an Indian weatherman, obviously, but that's a worry for the Australians, because there's a washout on run rate. South Africa finished second on the table, we finished third, so South Africa would go through to play India. But I suppose the bigger question after last night is, can anyone beat India? I watched their batting performance. You know, all their top batters are machine-like. Kohli got 100, the first man to hit 50 ODI centuries in world cricket. Phenomenal stuff. And all the other batters, they were treating the New Zealand bowlers, who aren't slouches, with absolute contempt. And then Shami came in and took 7 wickets. When the Indians bowl at night, nobody can beat them. That's been the record of this tournament, where India's won 10 in a row. So I hope Australia wins tonight. I hope we can catch India on a bad night on Sunday, but we'll need to, because at the moment they look like a cricketing machine.
Just before I let you go, Beverly sent me an email and she wants me to ask you a question. She said, and I paraphrase, but basically her email said, will you please tell Mark he's looking wonderful. Has he been able to keep all of that weight that he lost off?
Yes, Beverly, it's nice of you to say that and to notice, but some 18 months ago I lost 25 kilos, and my weight has been really, really steady through the course of 2023, which, you know, it's good to lose weight and get healthy and fitter, of course, but it's as big a challenge, Brent, to keep it off. And
sure.
Thankfully, I've been able to do that. So it's nice for the listener to ask that question, and the answer is a thumbs up.
25 kilos is a lot of weight to lose. How long did it take you to lose that 25 kilos?
Probably about 3 or 4 months. Yeah,
Gee, that's quick.
Right in. Yeah, I changed diet and got back into the gym and sort of been maintaining that weight, 90 kilos ever since. So pretty happy with that. It's not the easiest thing. And as you get older, of course, it gets harder. But yeah, it's worked well for me.
Is this the fittest you've been?
Oh, well, you know, younger.
No, maybe. Forgetting about youth, Mark.
Forgetting about you.
Yes.
Well, it is so long ago, it's easy to forget. But no, in recent, in the last 20 years, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, mate. Always good to talk to you. Thank you so much. Have a good week. And you're back in Parliament next week, aren't you? So I guess we'll talk to you from Parliament next week.
Yeah, we've got a parliamentary fortnight to finish the year, and there is actually some lively legislation, net zero, and some transgender stuff they're doing. So, that'll be interesting.
Talk to you next week.
Thank you. Thanks, Brent.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. Mark Latham joins us each and every Thursday, and we'll talk to him again next week.